Got your notes ready to take them? Lisa, you ready to roll? Never been better in your entire life? Best day of your life? That's what I want to hear. Jordan, what are you doing? You look like the Unabomber. This is something new for class today. This is something new, this red hat. Kyle, do you have a cold today? Sure? Sure you don't have pneumonia or anything like that? Okay. All right. Let me make some announcements before we move on with Dr. Stock. Discussion tomorrow is on gene therapy. You collected your articles last Thursday. And so keep in mind that genetic engineering as it applies to humans is really, you know, one of the apices, so to speak, of using genetic engineering to improve organisms. And you're going to be talking about using genetic engineering in improving human beings. And we started talking about this almost 10 weeks ago. And you're going to learn a little bit about the science in reading and also talk about the ethics in the future. And you'll be discussing cloning and a variety of different issues. And so please come prepared for a very intense and lively discussion. And let me forewarn you, it's not really forewarning you, but let me give you a heads up that every technique that you've learned in here in terms of going to the board and designing experiments and talking about ethical issues and asking questions and the predictions and approaches, all of those things will be done tomorrow, and all of you will have a chance to participate in one way or the other. So it should be a very fast-moving, very intense, very personal discussion, bringing to bear everything that you've learned in the past 10 weeks. And Mike and Gloria are going to dip back and integrate everything so that all the things that you talked about the first and second and third and fourth weeks in discussion will be brought to bear in tomorrow's discussion. And so please prepare. Last week was very good from what I hear, and I will probably be there tomorrow to see how good you are at dealing with these issues, which you've been really taught and doing very well on. I have to remind you about the oral exam on Thursday. I haven't picked for yet the question that you'll have from the quiz or from the take-home test. I'll probably do that on Thursday morning. I don't need to discuss really anything related to any of the logistics, except once again to remind you that you'll have two questions. You'll have be in groups. The groups will be different than what you had for your midterm oral exam. You'll have some time to organize your answers, and you'll have 8 minutes to answer your question and then 4 minutes for a challenge. And there'll be a lot of surprises in between. And as you found out on your midterm oral exam, which, again, you did fantastic on, sometimes things don't go exactly the way you think they're going to go. But on the other hand, we're going to have to keep on time because there is a class in here afterwards. And we have your class project to show. And on that class project, I'm going to need a script and who was involved in the class project. And I'm also going to need a DVD or a CD so that we can show it on the project. And hopefully it's not much longer than 10 minutes because we're going to run into some time constraints with the class that's coming in afterwards, unfortunately. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that. And we'll have a surprise for you, too, on Thursday. To touche, so to speak. So for those of you that are scheduled for dinner tonight, Jessica just informed me that it's going to be in the Napa Valley Grill in Westwood, and we have Shauna, Anton, Kyle A., Radina, Lisa, and Jessica. You're more than welcome to come along because you missed last week, so feel free to come today, and we're going to do that after the reception. Now, the main show. We already talked about Greg and all the things that he's done and everything that he's been involved in and all the books that he's written. And I already gave them your background and what you've done. And But the thing is that we're really, really, really fortunate to have Dr. Greg Stock here today, because I don't really know of anyone who thinks so far into the future on big issues that deal with humans and human cloning and human genetic engineering and all the things that we've talked about in this class and that you've been prepared for. And as I told you on last Thursday, Greg has written many books and has thought very deeply about a lot of these issues. He's been on many, many, many radio and television shows, and he's really quite an original thinker. And as I also told you, it's very rare that he comes and gives talks like this, and he's really doing it as a favor to me and to you, and to share some of his insights and his wisdom. And so since I've told you everything there is to know about him, basically, I'm just going to introduce Dr. Greg Stock and give him a big welcome to HC70A in the winter of 2006. And let me turn this off, Greg, so that you don't have that screen behind you. And,
okay.
Let me turn that down. And there we go. And let me pull the screen up. And then we're off.
Hi. So what I thought would be really fun to talk about today would be about big picture things, because you've been working in the lab a bit. You've Bob tells me you really have got a grasp of the science that's involved. And so the real thing is, how are these things that are occurring today, and they're so profound and so dramatic, how are they really going to affect our lives? And that's not just in the next few years. I mean, people can debate about those, but we're talking about decades and much longer than that. And there are going to be big, big impacts that reach far beyond medicine. And is this loud enough for everybody? Is there any? Do what? A little bit louder? I don't know how to do it. Okay, you got it there. Okay. So I think most of the discussions that you hear about in the news today are really, they have very little to do with the kinds of challenges that we're going to face from these technologies. Because most of the questions that people are asking are really the wrong questions. And knowing the right questions is really only half of the game. The other is having not only the courage to ask those questions, but to listen to what the answers are. Because the reality is that we really have a pretty good idea what the questions are, and we have a pretty good idea of the answers too, but we're kind of afraid to face them in a lot of ways. And so we end up talking about things like whether GM foods, whether we should allow genetic modification of crops as a big thing, or whether we want to have human cloning, or when the personhood of an embryo is. I mean, these are things that people get all worked up about, and yet they're kind of peripheral to this massive sort of range of change that's occurring today, and which has a dynamic of its own that is really not going to be interrupted by these particular little debates that we're having. And so there's a lot of angst about what the future holds. And if anybody sort of looks at the realities of these technologies that you've been looking into and sort of projects them just a little way into the future, they begin to see that very, very quickly and often recoil from that. And this angst about technology wasn't, you know, is fairly recent, I think, in a larger way. There was a lot more excitement. And I like a quote from Benjamin Franklin that he wrote in 1780 to the great chemist Joseph Priestley, when he wrote, "The rapid progress that true science makes occasions my regretting sometimes that I was born so soon. It is impossible to imagine the heights to which may be carried in 1,000 years the power of man over matter." And so he's sitting there, sort of seeing all these possibilities and thinking, damn, that he would really like to watch them, and realizing that he's not really going to be able to. And here we are, 2 centuries out of that 1,000 years forward. And if you project forward 100 years, it's boggling. You can't figure out what's going to happen in a real way, because it's going to be so profoundly different, I have a feeling. And 100 years isn't that far. I suspect that quite a few of you are going to be alive at that point, which itself is a kind of a radical departure. So let's look at some of the bigger questions, and that's what I want to sort of, guide you through, some major issues. And if there are things you want to interrupt me about, that's fine, and we'll have deeper discussion as I finish up. Anything you want to talk about, absolutely anything is fine. When people tend to look into the future and think about the challenges that technology brings, people talk about global warming, they talk about all the environmental damage that's being done, or maybe it's terrorism, or mass weapons of mass destruction, or the demographics of populations, that Europe is going to have a huge Islamic population within a generation or so. All of these questions, I think they absolutely pale beside the larger issue of how we're going to use these technologies that you've been looking at to alter ourselves, to change who we are. And the idea that that might happen, that people might somehow use this type of laboratory technology related to genetics and genetic engineering, basically, to transform ourselves in any meaningful way, seems weird. It seems strange, seems a little bit disturbing, and it seems kind of kooky. So that's what I want to look at, and to give you a context for understanding how the revolution in biotechnology might come back upon ourselves. And it's really going to challenge our vision of the world, I think, in a very deep way, and that's going to happen very soon. It's going to blur the lines between therapy and enhancement, between prevention and treatment, between the natural and the artificial. And I want to discuss a bit why bans are not only misguided, but they're very, very dangerous and aren't going to change where we end up anyway. And how this sort of, these deep understandings of our flesh, or our substance, of who we are, and our ability to manipulate these things are really going to carry us to destinations of new imagination, to issues of what it means to be a human being. And I think that it's interesting, you heard a lot of talk about that, or there was a lot of talk about it, you probably were aware of it, at the time of the sequencing of the human genome, when there were all of these metaphors being cast about. We found the holy grail of biology, you may remember, or we're reading the book of life, we're deciphering the code of codes. And it's kind of ironic when you think about it, because who were the people using these metaphors, which are all very, very religious, in fact, very Christian? And it was often scientists who don't even believe in God. So what's going on there? I mean, talking about deciphering or finding the holy grail of biology and these sorts of things. And I think it's because they see what's happening and they're trying to grasp, to grapple for language to express the enormity of what they see happening. And you could say, well, sure, is this really so immense? I mean, is this really going to be, is this just more hype, essentially? Because, you know, it's been 5 or 6 years since the sequencing of the human genome, and what's happened? Nothing very much that has any impact on us in an obvious way. I mean, heart disease, cancer are still the number one killers. I mean, I notice I'm still getting grayer every day. So the world hasn't shifted beneath our feet. And so there's a tendency to say, oh, well, you know, it was just exaggeration. But actually, these are changes that they accumulate and they're exponential. So you observe what's happening, and beneath there's sort of a ferment of understandings that are going on, and different streams are required to come together to affect something that is really observable, like genetic engineering or screening of embryos about things that are really important. And so when you're just stepping back and you're not paying attention, it looks like, well, nothing's occurring, nothing's occurring, nothing's occurring, nothing's occurring, but all sorts of things are happening beneath the surface. And then suddenly, boom, it's all here. So I think it's actually going to be very, very sudden, and it's going to be difficult for us to deal with it. And I think that when people look at this, they sort of think, well, this is a little bit reminiscent of what happened in 1969 when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And I know you don't remember 1969, or if you do, you're doing really well with anti-aging technology, but 2001, A Space Odyssey, you've probably seen that, which was a very popular movie, the classic of Stanley Kubrick, and you know, we were about to race out towards the stars, and everybody was talking about that, and here we are, and you know, there's no how, there's no mission to our own moon, much less to Jupiter, and it's, what, 40 years later. And so the question is whether when people look back 40 years from now, at this point, you know, 2040, after the human genome was sequencing and everybody was talking about reading the Book of Life and everything, whether people are going to be sort of smirking and saying, oh, you know, it was this turn of the millennium hubris and everybody was talking about all these weird things that were going to occur. And nothing has happened that substantially changed our lives. I mean, here we are, we're just people living as we've always lived. And I think that that is absolutely not going to happen. And the reason is that genetics and biology are at our core. They're not space. They're not something that's distant. As we learn to understand and adjust, modify these things, we're altering ourselves. And if you have doubts about how technology changes our lives, just take a walk in downtown Westwood, I mean, where, and look up at all the buildings. And these are, you know, nothing like Manhattan, but still, there are towers of glass, cement, stainless steel. I mean, this is not the stomping ground of our Pleistocene ancestors, these sort of hives of activity that we live in today. And so we've used technology to alter the outside world around us in incredible ways. I mean, I can come from the East Coast, get here, and I never actually have to go out from under a roof. I mean, if you step back a little bit, that's pretty extraordinary. And now, as our technology is becoming more precise and more focused, we're turning it back on ourselves. And I think that we will alter ourselves every bit as profoundly as we've changed the world around us. And it's going to change medicine and healthcare. That's what people talk about a lot. That's going to happen relatively quickly. It's already beginning to happen. It's going to alter huge swaths of the economy. It's going to change how we have children. I can testify to that myself. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter who was conceived in a petri dish. You know, so this is really big stuff that's happening. It's going to change the way we manage our emotions. I'll talk about that a little bit in a while. And it's even going to alter the human lifespan. And I mentioned that you are going to be here to see these changes. And that's pretty extraordinary. It's going to make us face and really think about what it is that makes us human. What are the qualities that are different from in us that are going to be different from an intelligent machine or another animal that's perhaps enhanced or whatever. And the question before us today, which is not what people are generally talking about, is how we are going to navigate this journey. And I think it's very important to see the choices here that are before us and to understand the context of this and the extraordinary nature of what's really happening. Because this is a moment in history that is not just a moment in human history, it's a moment in the history of life, in the history of the universe, and you're alive and get to see it. And it's pretty extraordinary. There are two things that are underway today that are unprecedented, and I mean in the history of the universe and the history of life, certainly, or this planet. And that's, number one, is a Silicon Revolution, which, you know, we all are well aware of. We have our cell phones, we have our trios, we have all this stuff. It's connecting us together in a variety of ways. It's creating artificial intelligences. But what's really happened is that the sand, the inert sand at our feet that we walk on, silicon, we're breathing a level of complexity into it that rivals life. And it is changing, evolving, far more rapidly than biological systems are evolving. And there are lots of people that think that that's our offspring, that we will be transcended, that this is sort of the technological offspring of biological life, and that it's going to move, it'll be the cutting edge of life, essentially. And you can make pretty strong arguments about that. The second thing that's occurring is the genomics revolution, which is I use as a symbol, basically, of all of the things that are occurring in the life sciences, metabolomics, proteomics, the unraveling of our own biology. We're coming to understand ourselves, the workings of biology, at a very profound level, sufficiently profound that we're becoming capable of manipulating it in a real way. Essentially, science and technology has slammed evolution into fast forward. And nothing is going to be the same once again, because basically we're seizing control of our evolutionary future. Life itself is seizing control of its evolution. And that's the thing that, as people, whoever, whatever they are, look back at this moment in time, those are the two things that are going to be thought of as absolutely defining. This is like a transition. That's going to characterize the nature of life in the future for not only hundreds or thousands of years, but absolutely millions of years. I mean, when you start looking, combine the rate of change of what's occurring today and the kind of evolutionary timescales or geological timescales that I'm sure you've talked about. I mean, try and project forward what human life will be 100,000 years from now, what life will be, where we're going to be. It's absolutely boggling. So the big question, I would say, of our era is which of these two revolutions, the genomics revolution or the Silicon Revolution, is the philosophical question is really, which is going to dominate? Is biological life going to be transcended? Which, as I was saying, there are people like Ray Kurzweil and a bunch of others who make pretty cogent arguments that that's very likely to be the case. Or is biological life going to maintain, is carbon-based life essentially going to remain at the cutting edge of life, at the forefront? To me, it doesn't really matter, because it's an interesting philosophical question, but as far as you're concerned, what really matters is biology. And it's kind of obvious why that's the case, because you're flesh and blood. It's our insights about biology, our ability to manipulate biology, that really matters. I mean, what do I care about silicon life and artificial intelligence if my brain is going to mush from Alzheimer's or if I'm just losing it? And that's really what's going to happen to everybody, even though there are, you know, fantastic special effects and everything. That merging that is occurring between humans and machines, there's the biological component, and that's what is really essential to us, I think. And to me, genomics sort of captures all of this, because that's, you know, it's happened very quickly, very recently, and we're getting enormous insights about who we are and the possibilities for altering ourselves in a variety of ways. And as I was saying, where things are sort of, they're occurring on a lot of different fronts, and then all of a sudden it occurs, all of a sudden it's sort of, there's this exponential phase of growth. Well, if you look at the Human Genome Project, you have basically the 35,000 or so genes. I mean, we know what those are. We know the various SNPs associated with those. They're assembled in massive libraries. We have DNA chips and other technologies available to read those out. The price is coming down very, very sharply to where you'll be able to read the whole genome for $500, $1,000 fairly soon, less than that before too long. So what's going to happen? There's going to be this tidal wave of genomic information that's just going to wash over humanity. And that's because once you get to the price point where you can actually begin to take detailed genetic information about everybody and compare it, and correlate it with everything that's going on, who we are, what we do, all sorts of things, you begin to get, oh, not single genes that are going to affect this or that dramatically, but sort of clusters of or blurs of gene expression and allelic combinations that have implications about who we are. And I mean, the reality is that no matter what people would like to say about our genetics, genes matter. They make a big difference. You just have to watch a little kid grow up and or sprout, I mean, a two-year-old, and you go, they have such strong character. I like the image of being the gardener, where basically you can do all sorts of things to screw up a kid, but basically you water it and they sprout into, what is it, a beet or cabbage or whatever it is. I mean, there's something there very clearly. And if you think about the things that you find that define you as an individual, that you think are important about who you are, your shyness, or that you're very outgoing, or risk for some disease, whatever it is, well, a good rule of thumb is that about a third to two-thirds of the variation in the human population for that particular trait can be explained by genetics. And, you know, that's a lot. That's a big window into who we are. And we're opening that window, basically. We're pulling back the curtain on that window. And that data comes from twin studies. I mean, you don't need a lot of genomic information for that. You just have to look at identical twins reared together, reared apart, fraternal twins reared together, reared apart, compare various aspects of personality and such. And there's something called pseudo-twins, which are a lot of times when people use in vitro fertilization or they adopt a child, something changes. In any event, they end up having their own kid. They end up conceiving. And so they're raising then twins that have no genetic relationship but are raised in an identical household, in the same household. And so what are going to be the consequences of all this tidal wave of genetic information that we're going to soon know lots of things about ourselves? Well, some of the most obvious things that occur within, I sort of think of it as happening in waves. The first wave is going to be over the next 5 to 15 years, and it's going to be medical primarily, or a lot of the implications will be medical and healthcare, that'll come from sophisticated, cheap genetic testing. And then there'll be another wave that makes that look like child's play, kind of. But the immediate things are the movement in medicine towards being predictive, towards preventive medicine, towards more personalized medicine. And that's because as we learn, if you could see things about your vulnerabilities, what are you going to do? Are you going to just ignore that? No, people are going to want to do something to prevent, to modify their behavior in some way. But it's so hard to modify our behavior. You know, people can't even give up smoking. And we all know what that is, how serious an issue that is. So they're going to want to take pills. I mean, everybody is going to want to take, to have interventions that allow them to stuff themselves with anything they want to eat and not get type 2 diabetes or not to have to exercise and not to have health problems because of that. So, but the question is, how, even if you had these sorts of, if you had various medicines, which I'll talk about, how are we going to understand what to do? I mean, you're now very well informed about these things, and certainly much more than the mass of American society. And, you know, what do you do? What supplements do you take? How many here take omega-3 fatty acids? A lot of you. So almost no one. You should probably all take omega-3 fatty acids. You know how they're starting to get in marketing into eggs and all sorts of things. So that's an example of something that is a very modest intervention with no downsides, and very rarely do people do it. I mean, if I can talk to any audience, and the most it'll be maybe 20% of people who do that. So what's going to happen when we're trying to understand this huge mass of genetic information? There's one counselor, genetic counselor, for every 200,000 people. So there's going to have to be some sort of combination of delivery over the internet, of sort of where people will have to get this information for themselves. Because also, when it comes to your genetics, you're going to know more than physicians do. They don't know this stuff. They don't have time to devote to it. And that's going to be the IT challenge of the next generation, is how to somehow give people access in a real way to this wealth of information as it emerges. Because people will want to get the information. And then it brings up all sorts of social issues. Who's going to pay for these kinds of interventions that come up? Who's going to pay for the tests? What kind of tests are we going to want to take? What kind of information are we going to want to know about ourselves? Are we going to be afraid to see it? I mean, let's take an example. If you could look at your genome, basically, say it's a few years hence, and there's actually, we don't have much information about what that would mean at present, what the information would actually, what use it would be. But say you've actually done the broad population studies, so you can get a lot of information about your risks in life for various things. And how many of you would want to look at all that information?
Raise your hands up.
If you would. And
hi.
Everybody here. No? Who wouldn't want to see it? So a few. See, I told you not everybody would want to.
Ask him that envelope question.
I will. So that's the example. This is the sort of capturing of a less, I'll ask it in another way. So say I have here this envelope. I mean, you don't know me, but actually, Matthew, I know you. And in this envelope is written the date of your death. You can do nothing to change it. Do you want to see it, or do you want me to throw it away?
I don't want to see it.
I was just kidding. Actually, Hannah, it's your date, Hannah. Do you want to see it? You do. So how many would actually want to see the date of their death, no change?
Raise your hands
Raise
up.
Raise your hand.
Hi.
And who wouldn't want to see it? See? It's about, in general, it's 80 or 90.
Tell them what you did when you asked me.
What?
Tell them what you did, what I said when you asked me.
In a heartbeat. Give me the envelope. I just have to decide how much to charge Bob for the envelope. So there's an issue because a lot of people don't want to see these kinds of, don't want to see tests. People delay tests for cancer, for prostate cancer, for all sorts of things, often until it's too late because they're afraid that somehow if they don't know, it's going to, it won't really happen. I mean, for me, my answer on that is in an instant I would want to know, not because I would be happy with the result, although I might be if it was long enough in the future. But, you know, say it's a week from now. Well, I'm going to change what I'm going to do in that week rather dramatically from what I would do if I'm just going along blissfully ignorant about about the car that's going to hit me.
That's in the 1,000-year question we were talking about.
We'll do that one. So I wanted to talk about some of the more immediate consequences. One is pharmacogenomics, and I'm sure you've discussed pharmacogenomics a little bit. So the tailoring of drugs, pharmacology, to our individual genetic constitutions, to our own sort of biochemistries. And, you know, that's something that there's been a lot of talk about. It hasn't really begun to happen in any real way, but it will. So it's a movement towards more personalized medicine. It probably means a lot better drugs. It doesn't mean that they're going to be any cheaper. I would think that they're still going to be more expensive. And the fact that they are expensive wouldn't necessarily be a failure, in my view. I mean, it's a success that we actually want to spend huge amounts of money on healthcare because there's something of value there. Because what do we care more about than our health when it comes down to it? I mean, unless we're, some people don't care, but a lot of people certainly care a great deal about their health. And the implications of that are that it means the whole FDA approval process is just, it's completely unsuited to an environment where, A, you don't have big blockbusters so that you can afford to spend half a billion or 800 million, although there's some issues about what those costs really are, but it's a lot of money to develop a drug and to get it it's really mostly about passing regulatory hurdles and doing all sorts of clinical trials and stuff. That's where the real expense goes. Well, if you are not going to be able to use that market for in a mass market way, then how do you recoup those losses? Does everything become an orphan drug? What happens when you start segmenting the population into little subgroupings? Well, you don't have enough to pay for that kind of a development process. And so the regulatory environment, as I see it, is far too risk-averse, it's far too expensive, and it's way too slow. And it's going to increasingly be an impediment to the arrival of new therapeutics, which is what people really want. And incidentally, if you actually could move towards personalized medicine, which is what people like to talk about, oh, we're going to take some sort of a genetic test or do all sorts of gauges of your metabolism and various sorts of things, and then we'll tailor medicine for you. Well, if you do that, how do you run a clinical trial? With an N of one, you know, one person, it's kind of hard to do that. So I think that where we need to go is towards allowing people to make statements about judgments about the risk that is involved in certain kinds of medication, judgments about the efficacy, the chance of efficacy that there is, and allow people to make decisions for themselves. And then the important thing is to actually collect the information. I mean, what's going on today is crazy. Here we have this completely uncontrolled experiment where everybody is dabbling into this and that, not only pharmaceuticals that they take, but nutritional supplements and functional foods and illegal drugs, everything. I mean, people are trying to do things to improve their well-being in one way, to enhance their health, all sorts of... And then we throw away the information. We don't collect it. We don't... If you collected all that information and then protected people's privacy in some way by de-identifying it and sort of sifted through that, at the same time you're sifting through all of the genetics of the population, you would find out so much more about drug interactions, because lots of times people go to a doctor and they don't tell them about nutritional supplements that they're taking, which have significant, there are drugs and nutritional supplements as well. So that kind of moving to that sort of schema is something that would be incredibly valuable, but it's really difficult in the regulatory environment. One of the things, so those are some healthcare issues. There are things that are social as well and that are economic that are bound to happen. Have you talked about insurance at all?
A little bit.
So usually the issue is presented, well, you know, we really need to protect people's genetic privacy, because what's going to happen is that the insurance companies are going to get a hold of this information and then they're going to deny people coverage if they're at risk. And that's actually backward in terms of what's really going to happen, because the insurance companies can't afford to pay for those kinds of genetic tests. It's very expensive compared to what people do with insurance, say life insurance. What's going to happen is that there's going to be a window of time, and plus it's illegal for insurance companies to do that sort of stuff, is that there's going to be a window of time where these sort of genetic tests become available and have meaningful information about what our risks are. And people who have any... who are savvy, they're going to go, I'm going to get myself tested. And they're going to go, they're not going to get tested in the medical system, they're going to get anonymous testing. They're going to take a little mouth swab like you did, and they're going to send it offshore, and they're going to get back a lot of information about the risk factors and their genetics and what it means. And then if you're at risk, what are you going to do? You're going to load up on low-cost life insurance and health insurance. And it's just obvious that people are going to do that to me. Although when I talked at Lloyd's of London, one of the people at Lloyd's said, really? Do you think people would do that? I said, I don't know. Maybe not the British, but certainly in the United States that would happen. And then it'll switch over, because the fact is that in terms of health issues, insurance is about discrimination. It's about discriminating among different risk groups. And it's about sharing unknown risks. That's what insurance is meant to do. So if you suddenly become aware of a whole bunch of risks, then insurance, as we know it, no longer functions because there are imbalances in knowledge. Either people are going to game the whole system, and if you find out that, oh, I don't have very many risks, then people tend not to buy insurance in the same way. So they'll be able to game the system, and then as soon as the insurance companies figure it out, then they'll start to exclude people who are at high risk. Of course they will. The same thing happened with HIV, where initially there was anonymous testing for HIV to see who was HIV positive, and then people started who tested positive were buying up huge life insurance policies because it was illegal to do testing, and then the life insurance companies got changes in legislation, and they began to test for HIV. And what happened is those people, then a whole industry came up, and you could actually, when you were within a couple of years of death, or supposedly going to die within a few years, then people could sell their insurance. So they had $1 million of insurance, they could sell the premium, they could sell the policy for, say, $500,000, which would be a huge profit for whoever buys that. Not individual, they wouldn't buy individual policies, but they'd buy them as a whole and package them up so that there wouldn't be any individual risk. And it was an industry called the pecuniary industry or something like that. And so people got a great deal of money that then they used in supposedly the last few years of their life. And then new therapeutics came about and people's lives were extended substantially. And that whole industry, a lot of people lost a lot of money because AIDS patients began to live a lot longer period of time. So the issue of genetic privacy, there's no way that you're going to have genetic privacy except for the fact that nobody cares. Because for you, I mean, who's going to follow you around and want to see your genetics unless you have issues of paternity with some child you've left behind or something of that sort. But if anybody wants to find out about your genetics, it's not very difficult because you're so careless with your genes. I mean, you just leave this trail of biological debris behind you. I'm going to walk out of the building and, you know, if anybody wanted to, they could pull some cells off of this bottle or off of the doorknob or whatever, and or at your barber or hairdresser. So anybody who wants to find out about your genetics is going to be able to. So the idea of genetic privacy, I think, is kind of a joke. The other area is things like sports, where you've already got these huge controversies about enhancement. Well, I mean, let me ask you, if there was, say, a natural Olympics where they were able somehow to enforce legislation and the rules so that nobody could be enhanced, they couldn't use and do any doping, they couldn't do anything, and there was another Olympics that was like the quadruple X Olympics where everybody had a team of physicians and they were all jacked up on all kinds of drugs and they were genetically enhanced and they were, which would you, you know, and they're simultaneous, they're on the same, they're on two different channels but at the same time, which, who here would be watching the natural Olympics? And who would be watching the other? So there's a lot of money in it, and that's why you'll never be able to enforce I think it'll break down just like professional and amateur sports. I mean, it used to be this big division that amateur sports was so great. Amateur sports has essentially disappeared. There's one class because people really want to watch elite performance. I think the same thing will happen in sports, and I think that in any event, it's interesting that people talk about society as a whole, that somehow we're going to regulate the use of these technologies when you have, in sports, you have a small number of people that are absolutely controlled in time and space. You can run any tests you want on them. They'll subject themselves to all sorts of things that you would never, the general population would never allow. You have all sorts of punitive measures that you can do. You can, you know, bar them from sports. There are lots of things that you can do just by proclamation. You don't have to, the person doesn't have to really get a trial or anything. And you still can't stop the use of these things. So when things are available that people consider to be of value, be they drugs, I mean, you can see it with illicit drugs. I mean, the war on drugs, not successful at all. So it's one thing to dream up, well, if I were designing the world and I was trying to make it a very kinder, gentler place, how would I organize things? I really don't want people to be using drugs or anything in sports. I certainly wouldn't want genetic enhancement. I wouldn't want anybody to be using illicit drugs. I certainly don't want, you know, genetic screening to go on, or I want there would be genetic privacy. It's really easy for bioethicists to dream that up, and then they have a discussion and they go, oh, that's really wonderful. But that's very good, I like that. But did you think of the problem associated with such and such? Oh, no, I hadn't thought of that. Let's pass another, let's make another law, or let's make another guideline. But it has nothing to do with the reality of what's going on today. Another area that I think is kind of interesting is the politics of dealing with all this genetic information. Because it's very, I know this is very politically correct as a class. Bob doesn't allow anything to be said that's not adequately politically correct. I don't think he tolerates political correctness, I don't know. But so you've all heard, I'm sure, it's really wonderful, the sequencing of the human genome, because we've found that, well, Daisy, if you look over to Shauna and compared your genomes, 999 out of 1,000 letters are the same. So we're just one big happy family, you know, we're all basically the same genetically. And then everybody breathes a sigh of relief. Whereas the reality is, of course, we're all the same, close to being the same. We're all alive. We're all mammals. We're all primates. We're all humans. And we probably look pretty much the same to a hungry lion. I mean, we all taste pretty much the same, probably. Or to some visitor from outer space. Yeah, those earthlings, they all look the same. But when it comes to each other, when we look at each other, we look dramatically different. It's that 0.1% of differences that we really care about. And if you're looking for a partner or a date or trying to put together a sports team, or you're looking for somebody to work with on a project, you're very sensitive to the finest of differences, the tiniest of differences, because we're in competition with each other for everything that we care about, basically, or for a great deal of stuff. And so the idea that we're all the same is just kind of pushing under the rug the issues that are going to emerge, because we're going to have to come to grips with the fact that not only are we different as individuals, but in fact populations and subpopulations have different genetics in very meaningful ways. I was talking to Kari Stephenson a couple of days ago. He's from Decode Genetics, the group that has sequenced the genomes of many individuals in Iceland, and is comparing it, looking for disease genes and such. So there's an allele that is linked to prostate cancer. And in the Caucasian population, it causes an increase in 30% of your risk for prostate cancer. In the Black American population, it causes an increase of 300% in risk for prostate cancer. And it's almost not existent in the African American population. In Africa, it's been eliminated. But in Americans from Africa, that there is, because of the mingling, there's a lot of transfer of genetics among a variety of populations or groups. And so that gene, against the background that is primarily African, confers a really high risk of prostate cancer, and it can probably explain the differences between the incidence of prostate cancer in Black Americans and in the Caucasians in the American population. So, you know, these are things that we're really going to care about, and those are the kinds of things that society is having a difficult time talking about at this point. So those are the really easy things. Now, when we get out a little bit beyond maybe a generation, like 25 years, which isn't so long from now, we're going to be dealing with issues that really are challenging, that are going to make that look like a little bit of a ripple, I think. And they're so divisive, I believe, that they're already causing legislation, and we're trying to respond to them, even though they aren't even here yet. Because they bring up issues that are very, very dear to our hearts. the three realms that I think are most important are that actually reshaping our biology in interesting ways. And by that, I don't mean we're going to want some gills or, you know, another arm or something. Because we don't really care about those sorts of things. And we can actually, you don't need gills because you can get scuba gear. So what do we really care about, though? Things like longevity. So what if you could alter, understand enough about the aging process so that basically you could control it? You could change its rate. You could even reverse it. Many people, real gerontologists, talk about doing that. So what if you were to double the human lifespan? And I don't mean just add another 75 years of decrepitude at the end where you're sort of, wake up, what century is it? I mean that you extended your period of vitality. Say you just aged at half the current rate that you age now. So if people live twice as long, well, it would change virtually everything about our lives. It would change the educational process. It would change the patterns of family formation, of having children, the passage of wealth from one generation to the next. And yet, whenever that comes up, the idea of anti-aging medicine, of life extension, what does everybody talk about? Well, I don't know. I don't think it would be a good idea. It would bankrupt Social Security. I mean, so that's the least of our worries when this sort of thing happens. And I think it's interesting. Tell me if you actually could, say you could take a pill and it would halve your rate of aging at this point for the rest of your life. Halve your rate of aging. So you just age at half the rate that you do now and get older at half the rate. How many people would actually want to take that pill? It had no other side effects. And who wouldn't want to take the pill? So, Brian, why not?
Well, this is just more of a personal kind of thing. I think that the kind of lifespan that we have right now is good enough so that you basically grow up really fast and you have time to actually reminisce towards the end. Whereas if you kind of extended your lifespan, I personally wouldn't know what to do with it. I don't know. This is just something personal that has nothing.
And I'll give you a lot of ideas here, Brian.
Okay.
No, it just seems. It also has a lot to do with the with being a Christian too. So. Living long, that's nice, but is it really necessary for me? That's just my.
Okay, great. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Did you want to say something, Ben? Pass it down.
Would you be the only person taking this pill? Like, would everyone around?
No. Let's say anybody could take it they wanted to. Because a lot of times people feel, well, you know, they don't want to get old. They don't want to outlive everyone else, all the people that they love. But, you know, if it's a technology that's available broadly, what's interesting is that essentially we've already seen what happens in that experiment, because it used to be that life expectancy was about 40 to 45. And, you know, a lot of that occurred in childhood death, but not that much. There was still people, retirement was set at 65 because the idea was that almost no one would live that long and collect on retirement. So if they had known now, it would be, you know, 90 or so. And so what's happened? Basically, here, if you think about it, well, it's had huge impacts on family, the nature of the family. Women who are actually surviving beyond the age where they're having children there's big differences in the role of women in society, and part of that's attributable to the extension of our lifespans. Another attributable to the fact that we've managed to develop, that we aren't having as many children as well. But basically, now you get people saying, oh, did you hear about him? 70 years old and he got a heart attack. I mean, he just retired. Oh, the poor bastard. You know, he was robbed. Where So that, and you don't get many people that are in St. Petersburg who are going, you know, I'd just as soon die now. Everybody's trying to maintain their health for a longer. If you talk about something like Ensure, which is an adult nutritional that people drink to get. What are the sales of Ensure in this country? Anybody has a guess? $2 billion. $2 billion are the sales of Ensure. Okay. So the idea, and yet I've heard many times where people will say, oh, well, we should try and somehow, we wouldn't want to allow people to have life extension if it were feasible scientifically, because it would cause problems. There are too many people on the planet already. There are all of these sorts of issues. But if it's feasible, there would be so many people that would demand it. I mean, there's no way you could keep people from getting it. All you have to do is to go into Westwood or into Brentwood somewhere and look at how much people spend just for the appearance of youthfulness. You know, just I was just looking at aesthetic dermal procedures, $16 billion market for laser depilation, for skin resurfacing, just things to try and keep it for a little while longer. So that's an example of the kind of thing that I think we will have to deal with. A second is managing our emotions. What I'm talking about is Ritalin, like for ADHD, Prozac, Viagra, of course. These are just little clumsy baby steps where people are essentially figuring out ways to short-circuit a lot of evolutionary programs that are entraining our behavior in different ways. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. I mean, what if you had, you're able, you understand the functioning of the mind, and you can develop pharmaceuticals or a mix of pharmaceuticals so that you could take some pills again to make it easy. I hate to have to force you to get a shot, but say you could take pills that made you feel just fulfilled. I mean, really happy to be you doing whatever it is you're doing. And that other than that wonderful feeling of just being excited about being yourself, there are no side effects. Who would take that? And who wouldn't? So that's the kind of challenge we're going to have to face. Because what if you develop something like that? And if you take it, it's very hard to imagine resisting taking that. And yet if you take it, then who are you? Why are you doing what you're doing? I mean, what are the motivations that you have? Why are you motivated to do something? And what it is to get those feelings that we feel are very positive, you have to do all sorts of things to be fulfilled. And that's the point of those feelings being so filled with pleasure. Just like it's not some strange coincidence that sex really feels good. I mean, that didn't just happen by accident. It's trying to get you to have kids, to have sex. I mean, you probably aren't going to be doing it if it doesn't feel really good. So if you can start to sort of bypass these programs and get these feelings very, very easily, I'll give you an example. Then you have problems, or it can be very, very difficult to deal with. And I think it's going to be enormous. It'll be the biggest challenge that we face, I think. And an example is take sweets. Well, it's obvious that we want to eat sugar. I mean, why does that taste good? Because you go out and, you know, you come across a piece of fruit, high calories, good thing for you to eat. But we're not really built to be living in a pastry shop. So we have these things because we like them all around us. And we do it with all sorts of other things that when we want to have good feelings, if we can figure out ways to generate those and short-circuit the requirements for actually doing difficult things to make that happen, then we're going to do them. And I think that the problems that we go forward with are, and it's already happening, people like to talk of, there still you'll see ads about all the hungry people in the world, but a bigger problem, a much bigger problem in the developing world, in the third world, is overabundance, that people are eating too much food and not balanced diets. And obesity is a much bigger problem than not having enough food at all. The third area that I want to talk about is human reproduction. And I mentioned earlier that my child was conceived in a petri dish and came out very well. We made her perfect. We decided to make her perfect. But, you know, these things are just really, again, the baby steps. Because as we come to understand the constellation of genes that sort of are strong indicators about various aspects of ourselves, and we start to look at that information and make decisions based on that, well, it's not a very big step to want to make decisions about the genetics of our children. And because people have different views about different aspects of personality, of temperament, will be interested in their vulnerabilities. People want, it's very clear that a lot of people will find that of great value to make those sorts of choices. And yet this is something that is a major taboo to talk about unless it's disease related. And yet you have parents that are going, I've had a number of in vitro fertilization physicians that will say, oh, I hate this business because, you know, people are trying so hard just to have a kid, and then I have parents coming up and saying, oh, no, we want, can you make the kid a little smarter? Can we have taller? What about hair color? You know, they're asking for all these things that are not really feasible at present, but it's very clear that they will be demanded. And there are going to be three technologies that allow us to sort of make decisions about the genetics of our children. And at one pole, and each of them is sort of built upon in vitro fertilization, you know, the fertilizing of an egg and putting egg and sperm in a petri dish, essentially creating an embryo and then implanting it in the womb. And at one pole is cloning, which is the one that's probably most discussed in the media, has all the controversy. This is the most conservative possible thing you could do because you're just copying an existing genetic constitution. You're bringing nothing novel into being, and it's technically difficult, but not that difficult probably since it's been done in all sorts of other mammals. It's of dubious safety right now. It doesn't have very broad appeal. There are very few people who are actually interested in doing it other than if they're in rather unique reproductive situation. And it's in the media so often because it's really a symbol of all of the things that are going to happen that people don't really talk about because it's inserting technology into this most intimate of processes. And it's interesting. I suspect it'll happen within, I don't know, 10 years. I would be surprised if it doesn't happen within 10 years. And when it does, it simply will not be that big a deal. I mean, not that it won't be treated as such. I mean, here you have a complete fraud announcement of a clone, and it gets a week's world press on it from the Raelians a couple years ago when they made that announcement, which they knew exactly what they were doing because everybody who was interviewed, I remember I was called up and said, that's a joke. They no way in the world they ever did that. But they said they were going to announce, I think the weeklies come out on Tuesday, on Tuesday they come out, like Time and Newsweek and such. And they said they were going to show the genetics on Wednesday morning. And so it kept all the weeklies from saying anything about it. They wouldn't report any. All sorts of people were saying this is total fraud, it's a joke. They wouldn't print it because they didn't want to come out and then have some announcement made. So they were just totally playing the press. But basically, it'll be the birth of a delayed identical twin, which is not that earth-shattering. I mean, most of you have probably, who's had contacts with an identical twin? Most of you. Who actually is an identical twin? There we have it. I mean, so people are similar and they're kind of different. And here we have a clone right in our own classroom. And So it just is, I don't think it's going to be that big a deal. And it's really astonishing that people would use that as a reason to essentially criminalize or attempt to criminalize a whole area of scientific research. And I'm talking about stem cell work and what's called therapeutic cloning, which is the same basic technology, which deals with real people who have real suffering and real families and real diseases. And it's kind of astonishing that we're having that debate at all, in my view. And part of it is that I think people who know better are unwilling to be direct and straightforward about what it is that we're talking about. I mean, not that there aren't other situations where you can argue about personhood, you can argue about when an embryo becomes a human life, but, you know, we do live in a country where you can abort a fetus up to the age of 3 months for any reason whatsoever, on any whim. So if you're going to have if you're going to have an environment of that sort where you allow that to occur, then why are we concerned about, you know, a several cell embryo, in my view? So that's at one side, is cloning. At the other extreme is germline engineering, the idea of going in and actually altering the genes, manipulating human genes for conscious human design. And that isn't as far off as many people imagine, I would say a couple of generations at the most. In one of my books, I talked a lot about using artificial chromosomes, where you actually add an additional chromosome and put all sorts of genetic cassettes that are turned on and off at the right time and place. And, you know, you have artificial chromosomes in mice, in other organisms. You even have some genes that have been added. The technology, I don't think, is that difficult, although it will be quite difficult to get it to a stage where some responsible physician would want to do it. And even more importantly, there aren't very good reasons to do it. I don't think there will be very much interest. And the reason is because it's so much easier and will be so much easier to do the same sorts of things without the dangers, because all you're doing is embryo screening, which is the third area. So everybody talks about, oh, human design and germline engineering on one side, or cloning, whereas it's already going on, embryo screening. And especially with what's called PGD, which you probably have come up, and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, you know the process. So that's already being done to avoid various genetic diseases. You couple that with an ability. Earlier I was saying how you have all these technologies that are kind of independently progressing, and then when they come together, you get something much greater than the sum of its parts. In embryo screening, that is very definitely the case, because you can do single-cell genetic analysis. You can look at what the various alleles are in a single cell. And in PGD, you're pulling out a single cell, and you can do that. And that'll become more enhanced, so you can look at large, large numbers of SNPs in that cell very, very easily. But they wouldn't be of much use, except for rare genetic diseases. We wouldn't know what we were trying to look at. We wouldn't know what the implications of it was. So that's one area where there's progress being made. Another is all of these broad population screens that I was talking about. So once you begin to get the database where you can interpret that information, which again will be over the next decade, all that will come into play, that will arrive, then you really have significant information. But still, you only have a few embryos. You aren't able to do very much. So another is that you could actually take an ovarian biopsy and get thousands of eggs and then mature them in vitro outside of the body. And that's still kind of, it's just beginning to occur. I've heard some breakthroughs, basically, where it's likely that you'll be able to mature, 500 or 1,000 embryos in vitro, eggs in vitro. And there are people talking about doing it commercially, because it's a pain to go through in vitro fertilization. You have to get hyperstimulation and inject hormones, and it's very, very unpleasant and not something that you would want to do lightly. So you get this where you can actually just do a little ovarian biopsy, which women will want to do anyway, or because when they're young, you can then freeze those eggs. And then at some point down the line when you've decided you want to have a family, maybe you've been doing something in your career, and so you're at an age, late 30s, early 40s, where it would actually be very difficult to have children if, because of the aging in your oocytes, then you'll just thaw those banked eggs, mature them in vitro, combine them with sperm from the partner that you have, or from a donor if you don't want a partner, and you end up with a whole bunch of embryos. Now, what happens if, rather than half dozen or a dozen embryos, then you could have 1,000 embryos? You could run, look at the genetics of all those in a high throughput fashion, which will be quite feasible, and project sort of a virtual individual, sort of what are some of the qualities of that individual likely to be. This will not be that hard to do. Now, you're not going to be able to say this person will be such and such and such and such, but you'll be able to say, well, it's pretty likely that they're going to, you know, have, be very shy, be this, be that. And people will make choices about what embryo they want to bring into being. And it's kind of, I mean, let's take it, let's see what people think in this class, in that if you had, because of infertility, you're already having in vitro fertilization, and you have a dozen embryos, because that's what you would try to do, to try so you have backups for a variety of reasons. Not because you're going into this for any particular, because you want to make choices about your child. So you have a dozen embryos. They've all been screened, as everybody will want to do, for serious genetic diseases, because, I mean, you're going to want to protect your kid from that, probably, or lots and lots of people will do so. But in this case, they've all been found to be no serious genetic diseases. So you have your choice. You can say, well, you know, I'm kind of traditional. I just want to pick one at random, and that was going to be my child. Or you can say, well, I want to sort of look at what that those genetic profiles are going to be and make a choice about something or other. It may be just the sex. It may be some predispositions that you kind of like, that the kid's outgoing, that the kid's a little bright, going to be a little brighter, that whatever it is. So how many of you would want to just get whatever you get, just a random embryo, don't want to look at anything more? How many would do that? And how many would make a choice about something or other? That's good. That's about, in the United States, if you ask that question internationally, and not even in a soft fashion, but would you want to use genetics to enhance the physical or mental capabilities of your future children? And you ask a poll basically with that question, then the low for that is in Japan, for the populations that were tested. Just let me finish that. The low is about 25%. The United States is about 50%. And in Thailand and India, it was about 95%. So there are very different attitudes about it there. So these things are going to be considered to be very, very valuable. And you can see how the whole process of reproduction would change if it became viewed as kind of crazy to just, I mean, you're only going to have one or two kids. You're going to just allow some random meeting of sperm and egg? Don't we care about our kids? You could see people asking that question. Go on.
Sam?
I was wondering if you inverted the question you just asked. Like, you know, ask an individual, would you have wanted your parents to look into a petri dish out of 12 and pick which one they wanted of you? Would you have wanted to be selected? Do you think the answer would change?
So that's a good question. Let's ask it this way. So you find out that, you know, you don't really know much about, you haven't talked to your parents much about what their motivations were for having you, and you sort of end up getting in a conversation, and it turns out that, my goodness, there were 50 embryos that they did, and they screened them in that way, and they picked you. So would you feel better about this, about yourself? I mean, you already kind of won. Or would you feel worse about it? What would that make you feel, Sam?
Well, I think it might question my idea of my concept of self, my concept of maybe that, not even religious, that I, you know, exist for, you know, whatever, some reason, not that I was sort of, you know, picked off of a, you know, assembly line almost, you know. I mean, literally, I mean, it just seems like it changes the relationship between the generations when parents are creating their, they are manufacturing their kids. They are, I mean, even the word you use, grow, to me, that, I mean, that seems kind of awkward to me, that it seems as though a child becomes an object then and not, you know, a
so
subject.
You've had
the
your,
dynamic
you've had
changes.
The same relationship with your parents, and now you've found that piece of information out. You're saying it would kind of undercut, you'd really question the whole nature of your relationship with your parents and sort of who you are. It would make you really question who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Do other people feel the same way, or does anybody, who would feel good about it? Why? Summer?
I don't know, it just kind of means that I'm genetically superior to all the other possibilities. That's kind of cool.
It's interesting when people, when you ask what choices would people would make, everybody always thinks in terms of enhancement. So if you talk, for instance, or communicate with a deaf couple, I've talked with several who will say, definitely, I would use this technology because I want to ensure that my kids are deaf. I want them to be deaf because I really look at deafness as not a disability, even though there's a paid translator that's translating what we're saying by the University of Washington. I don't look at deafness as a disability, and deaf culture is really wonderful, and I think that I would have a better interaction with them, and I want my child to be deaf. And they say, well, now if the kid, the same person said, now, if the child were going to suffer from something serious like vertigo, you know, where they'd be dizzy, then I would screen out that. But I want him to be deaf. Nico?
Yeah, I think when you were talking earlier that I was considering this, and when you bring up the deaf example, I think that brings it out real strongly, is that it, I think it's more social in terms of what's like a disability and what's just a trait that's, you know, oh, that's a trait. I mean, it's easy to say green eyes versus brown eyes, that's a trait, and deaf versus not trait is a disability, but I kind of feel like it's hypocritical for people to say that, oh, well, I would never choose, you know, 12 out of a lineup, I mean, one out of a lineup of 12, but I would choose to make sure that all 12 of those aren't diseased, because what exactly is a disease? I feel like that, like, you get into some gray area there, so that makes it difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting because there's this sense that somehow if we're defined by a genetic choice, that that alters who we are, that it somehow removes choice in some way, that we were, I don't know if you intended that, but a lot of people feel that. And what's interesting is if you actually separate from manipulation or choice or what's going on, generations are going to know their genetics at a very early age, because if we have all this information around, then it's going to be commonplace that as soon as you're old enough to understand, you know about your genetics, that it's just like kids run through personality tests to try and see what they have particular talents for, or what their risks are, or all sorts of things like that. And so no matter how we try and control the choices that we make and the use of the information, people will have that information, and that's going to be a huge thing in and of itself. So, yeah. That's the issue of enhancement. People generally think about enhancement, but actually, I think that the choices are going to be so varied. It's going to be like fashion, basically. I mean, and people will make different choices that reflect their own individual sort of natures and who they are and aspects of their belief systems and such, and it'll probably change very, very rapidly over time, or relatively rapidly over time, and I think it will step on everybody's sensitivities. The people around that are it very disturbing to a lot of people, the idea that somebody would be able to choose to have a deaf child because, well, for obvious reasons. And yet at the same time, if you don't allow that choice, then you're essentially saying, well, that's equivalent to saying an embryo that is fated to be deaf congenitally is going to, needs to be eliminated in some way. And what's very interesting is if you think of it in terms of the big picture of what that means, is if you could make those choices, and say you could do it for 1,000 embryos, which will be very easy to do, I suspect, then that's like choosing among one of 1,000 siblings. So you can get rather extreme changes that would occur very rapidly. And just by that kind of choice, with no genetic engineering or anything, you could raise the population of parents, for example, take IQ, because that's easy to, that's something that's quantifiable. Average IQ is 100, a standard deviation is 10. You could raise the average IQ of a population that used that practice and that wanted to select for IQ as opposed to some other trait by nearly 20 points within one generation. So you could get very, very big changes that occur quite rapidly. And you would, I suspect, get sort of self-reinforcing channels of where people make choices, but who we are genetically and in our environment says something about what we want, what we would choose. I mean, people who would make choices about athletics or about IQ or about sociality, or they're different individuals and they have probably different aspects of their genetics is different as well. And so it's not that it determines our destiny in any way, but it does say a lot about who we are. And if we start reinforcing, then you start getting these self-reinforcing paths that occur, that used to occur by birth, so that you had family names that were Smith, as a blacksmith, or Taylor, or Baker. You want to take a little break? Okay. Should we just take a...
Sure. You guys want a break?
Yes. Okay. Should I... And I can move it so that we can have a completely free discussion, because I'll go on. What?
It's great. Can you come back and finish up?
Okay.
We'll have a good discussion.
I'll do that. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. 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 No, no. When are we?
freestyle? Yo. No.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, if I could have your attention again. Loda, done? Thank you. Go ahead, Greg. Thank you.
Okay, there we go. So in the little while we have left, I'm going to run through a few things. Feel free to interrupt and interject anything you want, and then we'll try and have some back and forth and around about some of these issues and sort of challenge one another in various ways. What I tried to describe was some of the kinds of things that are going to occur. What's important is that, you know, not everything that can be done will be done or should be done, but basically when you have technologies that large groupings of people, that at least a large minority of people see as beneficial, that they can be done in thousands of laboratories all over the world, that borders are permeable so people can go anywhere to have them done, and detection is very, very difficult, then it's not a question of when these things are going to happen or if these things are going to happen. It's when they're going to happen, where they're going to happen, and in what fashion they're going to happen. And I think most of the kinds of things that I've been talking about are fall into those categories. And I think that this isn't some abstraction, that we will definitely go down this path. And the reasons are two. One is because these things are a spin-off of mainstream technology, that we are devoting tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars to accomplish, because it's the other side of the understandings we gain in attempts to develop new pharmaceuticals, to medical applications, basically. And you can't eliminate the two because they're just applications of the same basic knowledge. And so that's one reason, that you can't separate them out. The second reason is because that's what we do. We're people. And we try to use technology to improve our lives. We always have done that. We plant, we build, we dam, we use drugs in a variety of ways. We try to use them to go to sleep. We use them to wake up in one way or another, to kill pain, just to get high. We wear clothing, we pierce our noses, we cut our hair, we tattoo our skin, we straighten our teeth. You name it, we really do it in ways that we can. And we also fret endlessly about the possibilities of new technologies. That's as human as the fact that we use them. And so I think that these things will happen. They're bound to happen. And also we're bound to be fretting and debating about it and worrying about it all the way. And I think that there's often statements made that, look, what we need to do is to appoint a commission. Let's sit back and, you know, just calm down a little bit and we'll come up with a consensus. We'll decide how we should use these technologies, what we should do about cloning. And this is the biggest joke, because there's no way that people are going to sit down and then study the issue for a little while and come up with consensus. There's not going to be any consensus about these issues because they touch our vision of the future and of who we are too deeply. They depend upon politics, they depend upon religion, they depend upon sort of social mores in one sort or another, one way or another. And some people are going to view these sorts of things that I'm talking about as just the worst thing that could possibly happen, is that it places at risk everything that humanity has struggled so hard to make happen. It could destroy civilization. And other people are going, let me get it, you know? This is a chance to transcend biological limits that others have only dreamed of. I don't want to be in the last generation to live a normal human lifespan. I want to have various kinds of enhancement procedures. And I think that the stem cell debate is not in the least unique. It represents a whole series of controversies that are going to come one after another. And, you know, we haven't even been able to figure out abortion. And most of these things aren't even about, the stem cell debate isn't actually about stem cells. it's about the abortion debate. And you talk to anybody on either side of it, and you'll see that a lot of the posturing has to do with what they think is going, how the impact is going to be on the abortion debate. And so I think that the real challenge that we're facing today and that you are going to face as, or your generation is going to face, is not whether we allow genetic modification of crops or whether we allow cloning to occur. You know, these things are going to happen regardless of what we try and do. Although we could certainly take technologies like embryo screening and we could reserve it for the wealthy by making it illegal, because who's better suited to circumvent these kinds of laws? It happens in Germany where you're not allowed to do PGD. So what do affluent Germans do? They go to Brussels or London. It's just the less affluent, less educated Germans that aren't allowed to use these technologies. So it's not about what we're going to do in any particular technology. It's really about whether we have the courage to move forward in this realm and to embrace the possibilities of the future, and or whether we're going to pull back out of fear of the consequences of these technologies and essentially turn over their development to other braver people in other regions of the world. Because this exploration that we're embarked upon is about the human future, essentially. The next frontier isn't space, it's us. And that's what we're really interested in. And that's why we're focusing so much energy into this. And so the choices that we make are not going to determine whether we go down this path, but as to whether we will be in the forefront or controlling these sorts of things, guiding them, that we're shaping the future, or whether we're responding to it in some way. And that's an example with Germany, where they don't allow any of these sorts of things, or a lot of things like PGD, and they're very sensitive about it because of their Nazi past. And that means that they're just watching, basically. And I think that the issue is, why would we want to pull back? Why would we be afraid to go forward? What is it that's going to happen that we're afraid of? And I think that what critics of these possibilities, bioethicists often, a variety of others, are afraid of is not what they say they're afraid of. They're not really afraid that somebody's going to get hurt or that these technologies are not going to pan out, that they're going to prove ephemeral. Because if a lot of people got hurt, if they proved to be problematic, if they didn't work out, then it'll just be a footnote in history. It'll be, as I said at the beginning, oh, wasn't it funny what everybody thought was going to happen back when they were all excited about the human genome? What people are afraid of is that these technologies are going to succeed, and that they are going to succeed gloriously, and that they're going to succeed so well that you are going to be facing choices that are seductive, and that you are not going to be able to resist using these possibilities, be it shaping your moods, be it making choices about the genetics of your children, be it trying to be living a vastly extended lifespan. Because if these possibilities really, if there is that success, and I have a suspicion, it's the only way that it's even interesting in wasting our time talking about this is if it is successful. Because otherwise it's just, you know, some little thing that went on. And I think that what people are really afraid of is that if this is successful, then number one, they're afraid of ourselves. We're afraid of ourselves, that we're going to abuse these technologies. And actually, well, we're not really afraid of ourselves. I think Kyle thinks he'd be able to handle this stuff very well. But Nico, on the other hand, watch out for him. It's always the other people who are not going to be able to use them responsibly. But the reality is, of course we're going to abuse these technologies. How would you imagine we wouldn't abuse these technologies? We abuse every single technology we have access to. And so the important thing is that this isn't nuclear weapons. I mean, where suddenly tens of millions are going to get vaporized by some act of an irresponsible individual or by somebody else. You have a choice about whether you want to use this technology, even if it's very seductive. The other thing is of the philosophical implications of these technologies. People are very afraid that it's going to force us to change our vision of who we are, of what it is to be a human being, of why we're special, all those sorts of things. And once again, of course it's going to change our vision of who we are, but we could stop biotechnology dead in its tracks, and we're still going to have to adjust our vision of who we are, because there is all this technology that's moving forward on this broad front. I mean, look how we have to change just because of the fact that you can communicate at any moment, any time, with people all over the place. Just affluence. There are all sorts of things that are occurring that are going to make us change our vision of who we are. And I think that it's quite likely that the world that emerges out of the way we use these technologies, biotechnologies and other technologies as well, is going to be a very strange place, and probably one that, even though I love this stuff, that I would be very uncomfortable in. I would want to see it, but I'm not sure I'll find it very comfortable. But even more, I mean, you could understand that. That's not surprising to you, you know, an old fogey like me. But you're going to find it very uncomfortable, I suspect. And it's a little bit like, but look back. I mean, at your great-great-grandparents. I mean, if they were here, and some of them probably still are, they are very uncomfortable in the world of today. I mean, it's not that they can't get along in it, but all the cell phones, people don't know their neighbors. I mean, looking at pornography on the internet, you know, you name it. It's, remember all the complaints about video games there used to be? Well, it wasn't young people that were complaining about the video games, as I recall. So it may be that you're really uncomfortable with the future 100 years from now, but your grandkids or the kids that are growing up in that period are going to be, this is great. I mean, I wouldn't want to live 100 years or 200 years ago if you took it in its realities rather than some romantic notion of what that was. They're going to look back and say, my God, people got sick and got cancer and, you know, and they thought so little of their children that it's just some random meeting of sperm and egg, like we were saying. So the third reason, I think, is that people really don't like the idea of making difficult choices. And the choices are going to be excruciating, they're going to be very difficult, and they're going to particularly concentrate at the end of life and at the beginning of life. You can already see what's happening at the end of life, where you actually have to make a decision about when to pull the plug on someone. I mean, that's a very difficult choice. If you haven't made it, you will at some point, and it's not fun. And the same thing at the beginning of life, to actually say, you know, this life is worth bringing into being. This one I would prefer not to, to judge embryos. We have a problem in making those sorts of value judgments, personal as they may be. So I think what's happening is that the powers of humanity are becoming so extraordinary that we are essentially moving out of our adolescence and into our adulthood and need to begin to take responsibility for those powers, because we have them. They really are shaping the future in a very significant way. And there's a lot of debate that goes on about the issues of the kinds of things that I've been talking about. All of that stuff is basically on the side of life, in my view. The people who are working on these sorts of possibilities, and very few people are actually trying to bring them into being, but they're coming into being in a secondary fashion, they're thinking of it as being beneficial to humanity in one way or another, as enhancing our lives. But there's a whole other side that is kind of the dark side, and that's the possibility of designing pathogens, of, you know, enhancing biological weapons in one way or another, of doing things that use these same understandings to create life forms, to create things that basically are going to be very destructive. And I think that's where we need to be worrying, the things that we need to be worrying about. And the only way to protect ourselves from that is to sort of stay ahead of the game in terms of being developing new sort of ways of detecting, new antivirals, antimicrobials, those sorts of things. And so to me, I really think of it in terms of looking back at this period and what some individual 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 500 years from now, 100,000 years from now. Humans are going to be around a long, long time. Look back at history and sort of at this period. They're not going to look at it as some awful period when we trashed the planet and did this and that. You know, there may be a lot of trauma. There may be a lot of things that will go wrong. But they'll forget all that just the way we do. I mean, who thinks very much about the Black Death or anything? Killed a third of the population. I mean, we think about all the things that were produced in that era. And they're going to think, what an incredible moment to have been alive. That was the moment that laid down the very foundation of our lives. You know, that when they began to really understand and manipulate biological life, when artificial intelligence was created, when they began to first move off of the planet, these are the foundations that are going to establish the long future, and that you get to be alive to see all those things right now. I look at it as just a tremendous privilege. And I think you're so, you made a good choice to come into a class like this where you will be able to actually think intelligently about these issues, which are going to so shape your lives in countless ways in the world that we live in. And so that's kind of, that'll close the remarks that I really wanted to make. Let's start with, before I ask questions, why not, does anybody here have any questions that they want to ask?
Let's go to Chris.
Okay.
Hi. So I hear you saying, you know, as we lay down your arms a little bit, this is going to march forward, come hook or crook, right? So I'm wondering about if you have any thoughts of should we exercise foresight in any way? Right. Should there be any kind of, yeah.
So my feeling is that the whole regulatory approach is very misguided. In that the approach is, let's step back and figure out what these technologies mean, where they're going, and try and figure out where we want to get, and then how we can legislate ways of doing that. And it's a conceit, because people haven't got a clue where this stuff is going. I'm throwing out a few ideas. But nobody knows, and the reason they don't know is because it depends upon technological breakthroughs that we can't see yet. I mean, but you just have to go back a little bit to see how substantial they are, and upon the values of future humans that we really won't understand at this point. So my view is that it's not that you try and control everything, but you look at it as an emergent process, and the way to protect yourself is to gather as much information, like I was saying about getting information about all of the kinds of substances that we're taking and how they're affecting us, and try and detect when problems are arising, real problems that you catch in their early stages, and then you respond to them in ways that seem appropriate. For example, in vitro fertilization. There's been a lot of in vitro fertilization that has occurred. There are 100,000 babies born by IVF now every year. So there isn't really any serious tracking that's done to see if there are any sorts of diseases that arise, if there are any health issues. So you should really welcome the early adopters. People want to go off and experiment with this stuff and screw themselves up and whatever. They're like the canaries in the mine. They're like the test pilots that are going forward, and often they're very wealthy people, they're very well-informed people, they're making making judgments that they're very comfortable with. They're not being induced to do anything, and they often have enough money to clean up the mess when something happens. So get that information. I mean, if somebody is going to go out and try and do some human cloning, the first thing we want to do is make sure it isn't happening underground where no one knows what's occurring. We want to find out. So that's kind of a good question.
My question kind of involves the availability of the type of advances that are going on. So the big picture is that there's
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Big pictures, there's this sort of massive progress, these waves of progress. Is there any reason that this sort of technological revolution won't be like ones before it? Like, we have technologies that are old, like, refrigeration, sanitation, that, I don't want to throw out a statistic that's wrong, but at best, half the world's population benefits from refrigeration. Maybe that's, or at best, there's a lot of technologies that half the world's population don't even touch. And is there anything about this genetics revolution that would mean that there's not going to be large, like, dark spots on the Earth that aren't even touched by it? And is there a way to focus the development to make sure that wouldn't happen, focusing on the efficiency of technologies, making it cheaper before we race ahead to new ones? Or what would be your opinion on?
I think that it just naturally occurs because of the same, the wealthiest person today, if Bill Gates wanted to do any of the stuff that I'm talking about, he couldn't do it, okay? A generation from now, people of reasonable income will be able to do a lot of these things. The technology moves so rapidly, it becomes much cheaper. If a person, the best computer that the wealthiest person on the planet could buy 20 years ago doesn't even come close to touching what you have today. In terms of anything that's portable or anything like that. And so what I see is that, as I was talking about guinea pigs, is that you're sort of, I think we make a mistake to worry too much about the distribution of the technologies, although there are ways of certainly, it's not advanced technologies like this that we need to worry about in the developing world. It's access to clean water or something like that. But you see things that are technology-based that leapfrog. For instance, cell phones. You go to China, the cell phone coverage is much better than it is here because there were no landlines to displace. So I sort of see as the gulf not occurring between the rich and poor here now, but between one generation and the next. It's going to be over time. So that if you were to talk about enhancement, what anybody can do now, well, your grandchildren are going to be able to do way, way beyond that. So I see it as a process, and that is certainly not, it's not egalitarian in that sense. In the sense that you're talking about. Anybody else? Or do you want to, shall we ask some, so what are some issues? So where do you think we should draw the lines? We've talked about this. Let's take a very specific example. So genetic engineering. A lot of people, who here thinks that human genetic engineering, and I don't mean just genetic screening, let's say human genetic engineering should not be allowed. Is there anybody here who thinks that? Going in and altering an embryo, putting in a new set of some more genes, something or other, say it's pretty safe. Is there anybody who thinks you shouldn't be allowed to do that?
To what end are you saying? To what end? To like change hair color and things
like
that?
I'm talking about not disease related. Somebody wants to have, let's say somebody can go in and give a person greater, enhance IQ. Increase IQ in some way. Should they be, and let's say it's safe so that we don't bring up the safety issue. Should they be allowed to go through that, to do that on their future child? Does anybody think that parents shouldn't be allowed to do that? Be brave. I know there's somebody here who feels that.
Raise your hands.
Really? Boy, this is really, most people would not feel that. So there are at least a few people here. The question, is there anything, well, let's just see, is there anything that somebody believes you shouldn't be allowed to do? Brian, is there anything that you see? Brian Wong. What is there anything that you find disturbing other than, let's say, something with safe procedures that people would be in humans that people shouldn't be allowed to do?
Well, I don't know. I just think beyond screening for diseases and being able to maybe use gene therapy to replace those, I don't think you should be able to select for what you want your child to have. You should be able to love your child whatever they have. So I don't think enhancing anything.
Let's say doubling lifespan, increasing IQ, just picking up certain temperament? Or do you think you should be allowed to do that with your kids?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, just like personally, I wouldn't do it. But
I mean, legally, not that you would make a choice not to do it yourself.
Legally, I don't know if you can say that someone can't do that.
Uh-huh. Does Soja?
Lisa.
I just think that like the nobody should be able to do it unless it's available to everyone. Because that kind of, if you change, like, if you can raise your child's IQ, that automatically implies that you're putting other people who can't do it at a disadvantage. And so as long as other people can do that, I think then it can be an option. But if some people are excluded from doing it for like financial reasons, then you shouldn't be able to.
So you
can you buy a house, Lisa?
Sorry?
Can you buy a house?
No, not at the moment.
Well, so you can make arguments about, you know, sending your kids to special summer camps, that you can't do that sort of thing, which is sort of analogous in certain ways. So you feel that what you're essentially advocating is that there should be a program of universal access to genetic modification. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly?
I think so, yeah.
What do you say, Daisy?
Whenever I have discussions like this, I always think about Huxley's Brave New World, because I feel like if you start genetically engineering your children to be a certain way, like smarter or faster or stronger or anything like that, we kind of, and especially if it's universal, like if it's accessible by everybody, then theoretically everybody would want their child to be better than, you know, whatever. I mean, better is going to be different depending on who you're talking to. But then I guess the question would be, is it moving towards a society where, you know, people are going to have to be mandated to make lesser kinds of people to do the jobs that, you know, all the better people don't want to do, like cleaning or like food preparation or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of, I don't know, it's just something to consider, I guess.
So you have misgivings about the impacts that would have on society, basically, if you had easy access to genetic manipulation technologies of one sort or another.
Yes, but only because, I mean, I feel like that's the world we would move towards.
Let me ask another question that's more realistic, actually, because before you can do enhancement procedures on human beings, which is very, very difficult to do, the obvious place where you do manipulations would be in laboratory animals and other animals. So you'll get enhancement or modification technologies on other organisms, certainly on mice, on dogs, way before you're able to even attempt anything reasonable in human beings. So what if you could... Is there anybody who has any who feels that you should not be able to do a variety of sort of enhancement or pseudo-enhancement or manipulation technologies upon other animals? Does anybody have a problem with that here?
How many people have a problem with that? How many
One
don't?
There? Does anybody? So
raise your hand.
So that there's no, in terms of creating, what if you could create, say, a dog or a chimp and give it sort of some aspect of human qualities more enhanced, so you're essentially doing experimentation on animals that have some sort of consciousness in some way. Is everybody in agreement with that we should be able to do that?
How many people would say yes? How many people would say no?
Who says no? Does anybody have a problem
Just
with
no.
that?
Who says yes? Raise them up.
Oh, interesting. So you said no, didn't you? Was it you, Nejla?
Loda? No, go ahead. Nejla. Huh.
I don't know what I would say about that. And also, for the previous example, it depends if you're right about are people going to go for just one type of thing? And if they're going to go for this variety, that's a different situation. But do I want everyone running around with the same IQ, the same body type, the same skin color? No, I don't. So it depends on that. And for the animals, I don't know. I don't know how that would change just our dynamic. And like you said, how are we going to define ourselves?
So what, I mean, my opinion personally is that we're going to get tremendous diversity because everybody will make different choices. People don't value the same things. You can see that in terms of relationships. People value very different things in partners. There are some qualities that are somewhat universal, but there are very different attitudes about how much they're worth. And in fact, people want children that aren't that different from themselves, because otherwise they're going to say, you know, well, I'm really smart and I don't have any problems, and the only thing is I'm saddled with stupid parents who, you know, are ugly, basically. So, I mean, what do you sort of think if people had access to sort of genetic technologies in one way or another that they could make choices about their offspring in a variety of ways, as the way some of you said you would do? Does anybody have any thoughts about what they think would happen in society? I mean, look at fashion, the way fashion changed. What is how does that play out? Did you?
Samantha.
Samantha.
We saw a video on cytoplasmic replacement, and it featured this couple that, like, by no means would be considered attractive by society, but it was very, very important to them that their kids were genetically theirs. Mm-hmm. Like, this was a couple, like, they could go and get the best, you know, really eggs from a Yale-educated woman with a high IQ, but they really wanted their own children. And I think that what'll happen is, like, people aren't gonna go and make these, like, super children. They're gonna want their own children. There's something, like, very possessive about mm-hmm. your genetic information, and I don't think that, like, they'll maybe be comfortable with little changes, but they won't be comfortable with making huge leaps in generations.
So if, I would tend to agree with you that people want children that are kind of like them, but a little different, a little better, or a little whatever it is that they have issues with in their lives. But what if they're picking, if people were able to pick among enormous numbers of embryos, just screening rather than getting some completely different child, so it is their child, but what kind of choices do you think people would make? I mean, what would you be choosing? I think you raised your hand about making choices. What was, personally, what are the aspects of temperament or personality or possibility that kind of resonate with you?
I think that my tendencies would be to choose qualities that I have. I would want a child, like, maybe, you know, I want maybe a little smarter, but I like myself, and, you know, the qualities I have tend to be qualities I value, and I find a lot of people, like, the qualities that they, like, they all have qualities in themselves that they value, and that's what people will pick in their children.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Heather, did you have a...
I was just going to say, in addition to that, like you were saying, people don't necessarily always want something that's so different from what they already have. Like, each culture finds something else attractive. Or, for example, you know, some people might value blonde hair, some people might like brunettes better, some people like redheads. And I think there's enough variety in the populations as it is to where even if you were able to genetically engineer the color of your child's hair, or whether your child's shy or outgoing, I think there's enough differentiation in the populations that it wouldn't really make that much of a difference.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that people often pick the example of hair color or eye color, which not only are they rather superficial traits in many ways, but they're easily modifiable in the sense that if you really want blonde hair or some other color hair, you can dye your hair. And the same thing with eye color in some ways, with contacts. And so it's interesting that people, the vision of the future is always, on the images, on the brochures, are always these clones of blonde models, sort of the, which the idea that that was the direction of the Nazi state, you know, of applying, you know, genetic engineering or something of that sort. It shows the hollowness of that whole vision. Does any? Did you have something to say, Patricia? I don't remember whether you raised your hand. No? Okay.
Radina.
I'm not sure if Daisy didn't already mention this, but my, I don't really have a problem with people doing this. I wouldn't want to restrict anyone from making these choices. My only concern would be, isn't there like a really fine line between, you know, freedom of choice in these matters and eugenics? Like, what if all of a sudden people don't want children with a particular trait, like below a certain IQ? And I mean, IQ isn't necessarily predictive of intelligence. So you can be very intelligent with, I mean, I have no idea what the numbers would be, but you know, it seems kind of like, you know, maybe a little bit dangerous in that respect.
So you're afraid that people would, there would be certain aspects, certain traits that would be universally thought undesirable. Kind of like diseases today. I mean, generally, if people make choices, people would rather avoid certain diseases, which are still, you know, it's not like people with various diseases don't have a lot to offer and are not, can be a part of society. But certainly, many of the disease groups, the lobbies, will argue against this because it's going to reduce the numbers of people who have cystic fibrosis or whatever it is, because it'll reduce, they figure it'll reduce their position in society in some way, that people won't be making allowances for them and such. I mean, is that analogous or is that different from what you're saying in some way?
I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying that if someone with a disease isn't treated for it genetically, they will be treated, people will think that they should have done something about it? Look down on them?
Or that there are very few people. In other words, say that these sorts of technologies, let's simply look at screening for diseases and the idea of, is this available broadly? So say it's with genetic screenings of embryos, there's no way that you can tell after the fact that it's been done, because you just have an embryo. Who knows where that embryo came from or what occurred to other embryos. So if, say you were to make it illegal to do that, but it becomes very easy to do. So you can, you know, fly down to the Bahamas and do it, or wherever, your honeymoon down there, or you can get people to do it locally. And there's simply a test so that you avoid serious genetic diseases. Well, then, if the affluent do that, as with Germans, and the affluent Germans who, if there were something to do, could easily go to London or Brussels or whatever, then diseases, certain kinds of genetic diseases, would become the afflictions of the poor. And so society would come to view those very, very differently. So you have very interesting changes that would occur if these are not made available quite broadly. And I was thinking that some disease groups lobby very strongly against these possibilities because they're afraid that people will no longer have any children with trisomy, for example, and that therefore that they'll be viewed differently, or their children will be, or that society will not make special classes available for them or whatever. So I was saying, is there a difference between if it's a disease in some way or something that we view as a disease versus basically, so say no, there's a decision that people generally just don't like blonde hair. And so in a matter of a few generations, there are no blondes around. Is this a great tragedy for society?
I think so, yes.
Except dyed hair. Well, but if it's something that people universally don't like, then, for example, so you, okay.
Couple more questions for Greg, and then we're going to have our reception. Does anyone have anything to ask Greg who hasn't asked already?
Just one.
James? Loda? Isael?
You love that one. So the question is, if you could...
Book of questions.
If you could journey 1,000 years into the future, but not return. So you can live out your life, or you can go 1,000 years into the future and see what happens. But you can't come back. And we'll even make it easy that you can take a cluster of people with you.
Oh, now you're really making it easy.
I'm making it easy for them. You watch. So, okay, we'll do it hard first. That you go alone. So that's your chance. You can either go into the future and live in the future, who knows what it is, but you can't come back, or you can stay here. How many would actually go into the future?
Oh, I'm sorry, without your family?
Without your family, first of all. Get that hand down. So now, if you could actually take some, at least a few friends or anybody that you could convince to go forward with you, so that you weren't going to be totally alone in who knows what alien environment, then who would do it? Go into the future.
Raise your hands. Who wouldn't do it? Amazing.
So, Daisy, is there anything that would induce you to journey into the future?
Wait, are you asking me what? Anything that would make me want to go into the future?
Yeah, that any softening of the requirements on that would say, make you say yes.
I guess the only thing would be to know more what it would be like, because to know nothing and to go forward, I could go into an environment which is ruled by aliens or something, and
there could be nothing there. Who knows?
Or it could be nothing, like you say, or it could just be the same, which would be fine, but. I doubt that's what it would be like.
You like that when there's Werner Vinge wrote a book called Across Real Time, I think, where there are these little pods that people can get in and then essentially journey forward in time. And it's a popular thing to do, to sort of jump forward, but you can't go back. So it's sort of insulated. Technology doesn't matter, since it's all fanciful anyway. But so they go forward, and it's marooned in real time, I think. And so they go forward, and then at some point, nothing is there. They're just ruins, but there's no sign of anything, of any cataclysm or anything. It's just empty. And there are just a few individuals in these pods that have come forward. They continue to go forward, and it's never answered in the book in terms of what happened, but they're always speculating about what happened. The singularity, he's the person who's
sounds
in that.
Fabulous.
So that could be your fate, because Bob would be gone in like...
Pica seconds.
He wouldn't be here even for the final class, the exam. That's the way he won't show up for the
exam. Get away with it. Wait. Let's give Dr. Stock a really, really... thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And let's have a reception for Greg outside. And that'll go for about a half hour or so. And then Jessica will assemble everyone and march you where you're supposed to go for dinner.
So
leave your stuff in here.
Really interesting stuff.
And let's go grab some food.
So Bob,
you have to leave before the final.
That's interesting.
I've seen your brother walk away from the building.